Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXX and the start of the Catiline Conspiracy, part one, A Disordered Mind. Shout out to Sullust for that quote. Catiline is a notorious figure of the Roman Republic, a longtime rival of Cicero who, after repeated attempts at the consulship, decided to push the matter by force. In this episode, we look at his character, his role in the social wars of Rome, and his early attempts at office. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The conspiracy of Catiline is an event that takes place in what we call the Late Republic. We're in the 60s BCE, although we might well go back a bit further to look at the antecedents. And a lot of Roman historians, both ancient and modern, see this as evidence of a Senate and a Republican system that's not functioning anymore. Mm. But then they had thought that for a while, and this is just one of the more dramatic moments. I should say at the outset, some people question the word conspiracy. So we'll get into the weeds of that, but whether it was a kind of coherent conspiracy or not is up for grabs in the scholarship.
Yeah. Okay?
And as we'll be discussing, the evidence we have is very partial, and that's pertinent to whether you call it a conspiracy or it was just part of the rumblings that happened towards the end of the Republic.
Okay, so why is it a noteworthy event, or was it just so terrible, the events of it?
Well, it results in battle between Romans and Romans, so it's a type of civil war. It doesn't tend to get put under that label. One of the reasons it's noteworthy is that Cicero writes about it, and it happens in the year that he's consul, and he makes it important. That's one of the arguments, that it's a big event for him. And we've also got other historians writing about it. So there is an argument to be made that it's a big event because of who writes about it. But it is Romans fighting Romans, which is not something to be scoffed at. And it's not just, the word just is probably wrong here, but, you know, a tribune of the plebs being murdered in the forum or elsewhere. That has happened already. Mm. This is amassed armies against each other. It tends to get called the Conspiracy of Catiline or the Catilinarian Conspiracy. Some of the works that we've got on it are actually called The War with Catiline. So, you know, they see it as a war.
So you said that we've got some speeches from Cicero. So what sources are we working with here? I suppose Cicero is a good source because it is a source that was there on the time. This is an eyewitness account, which is always great to have, but it's also a very one-sided eyewitness account.
Yeah, he was a participant. He was consul in the year that it happened. Mm. And he projects himself, depicts himself as the hero of the moment that put down the conspiracy. So we have four speeches by him. We also have some references to Catiline in some of his letters. I'm sure we'll be quoting from his Catilinarians 1-4. Mm. Now, you say he was directly involved, and he was. But when we get into the speeches, it's worth bearing in mind that, as in many of Cicero's speeches, they weren't exactly the speech that he gave at the time. He wrote them up later and polished them up and probably changed a lot. And we think they were written in 60 BCE, so a few years later.
Okay.
So the version we have. But that's a major, major source, obviously. And every time we talk about Cicero's speeches, we're going to have the caveat of, but, you know, he's doing this to make himself look in the right. He is depicting Catiline as out of control, as an enemy. It's in his interest to do that.
And as for any other sources that we've got?
So the other major source is the historian Sallust, who wrote a history of this war. He called it the War of Catiline in about 40 BCE, so about 20-odd years later. It's a short history, but, you know, still goes into quite a lot of detail. Mm. And he's got those speeches of Cicero to depend on. He may have had other sources, and he was alive at the time and, you know, involved in the networks that were in this conspiracy, I guess. So he had been in the Senate, although he's a failed politician, so he's also got an axe to grind. And he's the one, well, the first one, who puts it very much in this frame of, this is a symptom of the decline of the Republic. This is a decline of Rome, really. So he sees that big picture of Rome grinding to a halt and needing some kind of savior.
Mm. Okay. And then we've got later authors who cover this in amongst expanses of history that they cover.
Yeah. So we've got Velleius Paterculus, who writes a fairly short history of Rome. The conspiracy of Catiline comes up in book two. It's only a two-book history. He's writing at the time of the Emperor Tiberius. He's very much influenced, I think, by what's going on in the reign of Tiberius. It's been argued that his depiction of Catiline is influenced by the character and behavior of Sejanus, as a kind of traitor figure. We've also got Appian writing in book two, so just a few chapters on this conspiracy towards the end of the first century CE. And Dio later again, of course, seeing that he's a major source for the emperors, especially the later ones. But he tells it in about 20 chapters in book 37 of his enormous history of Rome. There is an argument made by a major scholar in this area, Barbara Levick, who's written a book called Catiline, that all those later authors, later than Sallust, draw on Livy, who had published his enormous history over years. We've only got a summary of this particular period, which isn't really that helpful.
An epitome.
An epitome, exactly. All of these historians really make Cicero the hero of the piece. So you could argue they're all drawing on Cicero as a source, ultimately.
Maybe Cicero was the hero of the piece.
Maybe he was. Maybe I shouldn't be so cynical. But Barbara Levick is very cynical about this. She absolutely questions the Ciceronian version.
Yeah.
And she is one of the people who doesn't see it as a coherent conspiracy, but a kind of blip in the slow dying of the Republic.
Significant blip, though. So introduce us then to the major characters in this. Who is Catiline and why are we naming the conspiracy after him?
He does seem to be the leader of something that goes on in 63, and he is a fascinating figure. Even though I've been saying there are questions about whether it's a conspiracy, it is really interesting to look at because it shows us this conflict that's going on, that has gone on in a way for centuries in Rome between the orders, because Catiline comes from a very patrician family, perhaps the most patrician family alongside, say, Julius Caesar's family. His full name is Lucius Sergius Catilina. So in Latin, his name's Catilina, but we're going to call him Catiline because that's the anglicized version. Mm-hmm. And I guess we'd call him Lucius as well. And the Sergii, that nomen, his middle name, they're a family that can trace so far back that they get linked with the heroes of the Trojan War by, say, Virgil. Puts Sergius as one of Aeneas's mates who escaped from Troy.
Everyone is descended from somebody who escaped Troy, it seems.
Well, if you've got a renowned family, then as Caesar's family were doing, linking back directly to Aeneas, to Aeneas's son, then that's what you want to do. And it's kind of something the Greeks had done as well, although they would associate themselves with the winning side. For the Romans, it's usually linking back to those Trojan ancestors, or sometimes Greeks too, depending on where they came from.
So we're talking about an important and wealthy Roman family then that he's from.
They had been wealthy. They seem to have squandered that wealth. Possibly it's Catiline's own father who'd squandered a lot of it. I mean, they're not poor in Roman terms.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of dirt poor people who don't know where the next meal's coming from. But given how much money you need to be in the Senate and given how much wealth some Romans did have, they are not super wealthy, but they are super well connected and extremely aristocratic. And Catiline, we think he was born around 108, but even that is based on evidence we're not quite sure about. We know that he was the praetor in 68 BCE, and you had to be at least 40 to be praetor. Although by this stage, the Romans were breaking those rules now and again.
Yeah.
And because he came from such a renowned family, who knows? So, you know, we think he's born around 108. So even though Catiline came from this very high status family, no one in his family had been consul since the 5th century BCE. 429 BCE, Gnaeus Sergius Fidanus Coxo, great name. So they're not living up to the expectations, I guess. They're not only are they losing their wealth, they're not filling those high status political roles anymore. It's so long back that they were a consular family that you could almost forget about it. I mean, it's very hard to trace back this far in time anyway. Little minor point of trivia. His great-grandfather, Marcus Sergius Silus, is the first person known to be equipped with a prosthetic hand. And he was a soldier, celebrated soldier, in the Second Punic War, so the war against Hannibal.
So you said this is a powerful family, but like a star on the decline.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's the situation that Catiline is in then, when he's trying to build his political career.
Yeah, and look, I think one of the reasons that Catiline starts to stand out in our history of that period is that it can be depicted as this high-born patrician, but, you know, failing in the money stakes and family hasn't lived up to itself, pitted against, in 63, Cicero, who's the new man. Mm. So, you know, this phenomenon of the new man who hasn't had a consul in his family, who comes from provincial Italy, who's kind of getting there by his own talents, that they're sort of natural enemies. As we'll see, this is not true. Cicero did not instantly see Catiline as an enemy, and the various times he thought of collaborating with him. It's the way the events of 63 are presented that they become enemies.
Mm.
But it's not as simple as we've got these patrician families in decline and then these new men rising and the patricians hate the new men. It's much more complex than that. But we definitely do have these patrician families in decline. And what they do with that is interesting. What Julius Caesar does with it eventually is to take over as dictator of Rome. As far as we can tell, Catiline's ambitions are to be consul, to kind of revive the way that his family had acted in the Republic.
Mm.
But how he goes about it brings him into conflict with the consul of that year.
Okay, so can you paint me a bit of a picture then? We've got all these sources that are, it sounds like, largely negative about Catiline, but they're going to be very eager to present their case as to why he's such a despicable Roman. So what are they telling us about him as a person, and how much do you buy it?
Oof. Well, it's a bit like when we talk about the way that women are represented in Roman texts quite often. And, you know, they're seen as evil if they've got any power, that kind of thing. You could almost see Catiline in that line, because Sallust and Cicero both give us an extremely terrifying picture of Catiline, to be honest, full of negative traits, some potentially positive, but as we'll see, he misuses those positive traits. So he's very ambitious. You know what? Most elite Romans were. He's jealous. He's manipulative. He's often depicted as a monster. But the other side of it, he is depicted as clever and tough, consistently by Sallust, Cicero, and others, as being able to endure heat and cold and having to live rough like a soldier does.
Mm.
Even though he's depicted as part of this fall of the Republic because of luxury, he himself has the capacity to be extremely strong. So the idea here is that he wastes these inborn talents that he's got. He's clever and he's strong, but he puts them to bad use.
So praise him to a certain extent, but, you know, in a negative way.
Yeah, and by the time they're telling us that he is tough like this, he's already being depicted as an enemy of the Republic. Mm. So I guess you could argue that that makes him a more scary enemy. To use another parallel, the way we've often seen, you know, northern barbarian leaders as being tough enemies. So, you know, when we defeated them, it was something special,
yes,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there might be a little bit of that going on. But yes, he has potential, but he definitely wastes it, is the big message here. And there's a good quote near the beginning of Sallust's History of the War of Catiline, as he calls it. He tells us in chapter 5, from youth up, he, Catiline, reveled in civil wars. So he liked conflict within the Roman family, as it were. He reveled in civil wars, murder, pillage, and political dissension.
So he's a true crime junkie.
Yeah, I guess so. But not just, you know, listening to podcasts on it, actually engaging in it. Amid these, he spent his early manhood. So this is kind of youth out of control, something that we often see in Roman texts. Here we get the toughness. His body could endure hunger, cold, and want of sleep to an incredible degree. His mind was reckless. I'm pretty sure the word used there is audax, that means audacious, bold, but here, definitely negatively. It was reckless, cunning, treacherous, capable of any form of pretense or concealment. Covetous of others' possessions, so there's the kind of greed, jealousy. He was prodigal of his own, so he wasted what he had. As we'll see, he does come into money at some point, and apparently he gets rid of it very easily.
Mm.
He was violent in his passions. This is a terrible thing for a Roman man to be. You want that balance, that kind of stoic ideal of being able to be contained, and he's not. He possessed a certain amount of eloquence, something that's really good for a Roman man involved in politics, but little discretion. This is my favourite line. His disordered mind ever craved the monstrous, incredible, gigantic. So he kind of wants more and more and more. And the Latin for disordered mind is vastus animus. And the word vastus is where we get vast from. It comes to mean disordered through thinking about of empty land that's unused, that it's rough. So there's a lot that's kind of rough around the edges with Catiline, this idea that he hasn't allowed himself to be trained to be a kind of contained Roman man in the service of the state. Everything's just bursting out. His passions are bursting out from him. He's not going to be a serviceable Roman with this kind of character.
It's a great quote. It makes him sound very immature, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the impression we get. I mean, by the time we get to the 63, the conspiracy, if he was born in 108, then he's well into his 40s.
Mm.
That's the kind of age of maturity. You know, you can be consul at 42.
He should be mature.
He should be mature by that point.
You say, sitting across from the guy in his 40s wearing jeans and a cat t-shirt.
Yeah, but you're very professional as well.
Yeah, sure. Wow. It'd
be interesting to see if, I can't quite remember at the moment, any quotes about the way Catiline dresses come up.
He wore jeans and a cat t-shirt and always Converse shoes.
Well, trousers would definitely make you a barbarian for the Romans.
All right. So all of this Catiline activity, conspiracy, will happen against the backdrop, the aftermath of what we call the social wars in Rome.
Yeah, the social wars and then I guess the civil war between Marius and Sulla.
Mm.
So we've got all of this conflict in the early first century BCE when he's a young man.
Okay. Can you nutshell that? Because those would be formative years for him and Cicero, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So the social wars are a conflict between Rome and its allies. That's why it's called social, the Socii, the allies in Italy. The allies felt they'd been treated unfairly because they didn't have full citizenship rights. So they're burdened more with taxation. Their land gets taken away and more frequently, especially now that Roman armies are looking for places to settle veterans. So it's a war that goes on between the allies and Rome from 91 to 88 BCE. And they get what they want at the end of it.
Mm.
So they get increased citizen rights.
Quite amazing just, you know, how small Rome was up until that point. Rome was just essentially the city and the outskirts of it. And the rest of Italy kind of pushed its way into the empire almost.
Yeah, I mean, they've got more rights than the provinces.
Yeah.
Because they have Latin rights and, you know, there are Italian rights. But yes, they want the
same. But it was almost like a class system.
Yeah, almost. This is an aside and we don't have time to go into it in detail, but there is an argument that Rome tries to keep running itself as if it's small, and that's what stops working, and that helps with the fall of the Republic.
Yeah.
That the systems that worked when you were a small city-state with gaining a lot of military power and an empire don't work when you're becoming really, really big.
So what was Catiline's role in the social wars then?
Well, he starts to have a military career. So if you think he's pretty young at this point, he's in his mid-20s. He serves under Pompeius Strabo, who is Pompey the Great's dad.
Mm.
So alongside Pompey the Great, who is not yet great because that comes in the 70s. And Cicero seems to have been there too. So, you know, they know each other from fairly early on, which is not surprising because it's a pretty small group, isn't it? The Roman elite.
Yeah.
We know that he was there because he is named, well, we're pretty sure it's him, a Lucius Sergius. Don't get the Catilina bit. Mm. As we'll see, lots of the evidence for Catiline's early life is sort of...
We think
sort
that's
of
him.
Inference.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this comes from an inscription. So if it is Catiline, it's good evidence. It's not just drawing on some fragment that we think means this. And there's a whole list of people on this bronze tablet, which was once on an unknown public building in Rome.
Mm.
And it records the names of Pompeius Strabo's council, his consilium, the little group, who granted citizenship to 30 Spanish horsemen, equestrians, who had served under him in the social wars.
Right. Okay.
So this is a grant of citizenship document, in effect. And his name is, it's a long list of people. He's the 46th named. But we know that he's important enough to have been in the council of Pompeius Strabo. You can now go see if it's on display, this bronze inscription in the Capitoline Museum. But it literally puts him there. So we talked about the social wars, which are this kind of crucial moment for the Italians in their relationship with Rome. Catiline, as far as we know, didn't play a huge part in the war that follows, the civil war, or the conflict between Marius and Sulla, but he was definitely on the Sullan side. So Sulla is, you know, if you're going to divide them into groups at this stage, he's one of the optimates, one of the best men, and Marius is seen as a populares, a man of the people. Remember, Marius is the one who is then connected to Julius Caesar a bit down the line.
Mm.
And he is depicted in our sources, we get a taste of this in Cicero, as being involved in the proscriptions that happen during and follow the war. So Sulla puts out a list of proscribed people.
Right.
Thousands of Romans, you know, dragged off and murdered. Part of their property goes to the person who got rid of them.
So does he get money this way?
He gets a lot of money this way. It makes him extremely rich.
Wow.
But allegedly, he wasted that money on fast living.
That's what you were referring to.
I am, but there'll be another fortune coming later. So there's kind of waves of money coming into Catiline. And this is part of the, you know, Sallust's point that he wants other people's money. I mean, he's referring to the proscriptions there, I'm sure, that he took other people's money. He may have murdered people for dubious reasons, you know, were they really on the list, as we'll see. But then he wastes that money. Well, the word that Sallust used, he was prodigal of his own possessions. So didn't look after them, didn't invest them.
Okay. Around this time, Catiline is implicated in a murder. Can you give us some context for that and take us through it? Firstly, who is being murdered?
So a man called Gratidianus. So if Catiline was married to Gratidia, then somebody from the same family. And the evidence we have says that he's murdered in a really horrific way. But Catiline's involvement is debatable, all right, because it's based on fragmentary evidence. So this man is called Marcus Marius Gratidianus. So part of the Marian family, as I've said. He is Marius's nephew. That means he might be Catiline's brother-in-law if Catiline was married to Gratidia. He may also be a distant relative of Cicero. Well, he is, but we're not sure quite how distant. They're all enmeshed together. You can see how incestuous the Roman aristocracy is, even a supposed outsider like Cicero. He's definitely on the popularis side of politics, if you want to label people. He's one of those economic reformers. And he's perhaps most known for being the prosecutor who had brought about the prosecution and then execution of the father of one of the optimates politicians. So Quintus Lutatius Catulus.
All right. So this could be a politically motivated murder.
Yes, it could be. It's usually seen as revenge for that execution.
Mm.
So the involvement of the son, Catulus, who is, you know, major player on the optimate side, on the Sullan side, as we go through the decline of the Republic, that he's involved, whether Catiline actually carried it out or was involved at all. Sometimes you will read in books just that he was.
Yeah.
But it's debatable. The evidence is suggested by a man called Asconius, who is writing commentaries on Cicero's speeches. We're not talking about medieval commentaries here. They're written in antiquity. More explaining context commentary. So apparently he's writing them for his sons, so they understand the context of Cicero's speeches.
Yeah.
But sometimes we have commentaries of Asconius for speeches of Cicero that we've lost.
And that's what this is?
That's what this is. Mm. So this is a lost speech of Cicero called In Toga Candida, on the white toga. And the white toga is the one that you wear when you're a candidate for office.
Okay.
So this is a speech from his electoral campaign to be consul. So in 64, he's campaigning to be the consul of 63. This is Cicero. This is the moment where he's going to go up against Catiline. We'll go into a lot more detail about that later.
Oh, so you slandered the opposition.
Yeah.
And you say he killed his brother-in-law.
Yeah.
In the most brutal way.
Yeah.
Which is...
So a work of Sallust, but not the Catiline War, which is interesting, or the Conspiracy of Catiline. Another work of his called The Histories is fragmentary. And he tells us that Gratidianus had his life drained out of him piece by piece, in effect. His legs and arms were first broken and his eyes gouged out.
Wow, that sounds like real punishment, torture before death kind of thing.
It's nasty, isn't it? I mean, yeah. That comes from some kind of horrific horror film. You know, the fact that Sallust talks about this event, but he doesn't attribute it to Catiline, who's a kind of major evil character in presumably two of his works, because I can't imagine he treated him differently in the histories.
Yeah.
Suggests that it wasn't at that time known as a crime attributed to him. You know, Sallust is not giving us any sanitized version of Catiline.
Because if it was Catiline, why wouldn't he just say, by the way, Catiline did this? I take this as part of the character building of Catiline almost, whether it happened or not, that we're meant to read these sort of accounts and go, right, this man is capable of this. So what else do we know that he is capable of, or what else is he accused of prior to the conspiracy? You've got to build up why this guy is such a traitor.
Yeah, and some of it happens in retrospect, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you can see it going on with modern politicians. If you can't trust, to bring an example out of nowhere, what say in Parliament,
yeah,
that they might lie to Parliament,
yeah,
then can you trust them to be the leader of your nation?
Mm.
And some people will say, oh, it's trivial, it doesn't matter. And others will say, well, it's a symptom of that kind of leadership. So I think, yeah, this is a symptom of how depraved Catiline is. And some of these you can imagine get added on later. So it's sort of layers and layers of how violent and out of control he is.
Mm.
It's not surprising that he ended up mounting this conspiracy against the state. You know, there are other crimes as well that are attributed to him, some of which look like they sort of slightly overlap, so there might have been confusion. For example, he's accused of murdering another brother-in-law. If Gratidianus was his brother-in-law, if he was married to Gratidia, then maybe that has come from a conflation of the accusation that he murdered Quintus Caecilius. Now, Quintus Caecilius was on Sulla's proscription list, and we know that Catiline was involved in carrying out some of those prescriptions.
Mm.
And it's thought by some scholars that Catiline used this place on the prescription list as an excuse to get rid of him, even perhaps, if we're mounting our own conspiracy theory, that he put his name on afterwards, like murdered him and then said, oh, he was on the list all the time. And that brother-in-law murder might have been conflated with the Gratidianus. So you can see how the Gratidianus murder, because it looks too similar to this story, one of them might have been true or an early accusation, and then the other one got built on that. Because murdering two brother-in-laws seems excessive.
At that point, it's a pattern.
Now, Cicero, in one of his speeches from 63, although probably published slightly later, the first speech against Catiline, accuses Catiline of having murdered his first wife in order to marry his second wife. That first wife might have been Gratidia, but Cicero doesn't name her. So supposedly, Cicero says he murdered his first wife in order to marry the wealthy and beautiful Aurelia Orestilla, who was daughter of the consul of 71 BCE.
All right, so marrying up.
Kind of, you know, we've said he comes from very aristocratic circles, but he hasn't had a consul around in his family for a while, so this is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And also, Cicero says, he also did something worse. And
worse in that than very first wife.
Yeah.
Mm.
That very Ciceronian way, he doesn't say any more about it. He leaves it to your imagination.
Just a little needle drop.
Yeah. But Sallust tells us what it is.
Oh.
He says the worst thing is murdering his own son. Catiline murdered his own son because Aurelia didn't want a grown son in the family.
Wow, that's...
Now we have to remember these are very, very partial accounts. Partial in the sense of, you know, being biased, extremely biased, prejudiced.
Yeah. Well, I think it'd be terrible for any father to murder a son, especially over something so trivial. There's also the added layer of the Roman importance in having lineage.
Mm.
So I really don't buy that. But
yeah, I mean, the worst crime you can commit is murdering your father.
Yeah.
But murdering your son is probably second worst.
So all of these that you're going to come out with are Cicero-related claims, aren't they?
Yeah, and Sallust adds to what Cicero claims.
This reminds me of the Philippics, where Cicero essentially drags Mark Antony's laundry list out of the works in front of the Senate and then later on publishes them from a safe distance.
And he's, well, how safe is he really?
Ultimately.
not eventually. Yeah, except there are only four against Catiline, and maybe he's got him more into his stride by the time he gets to Antony.
All right. So what is the laundry list? He's killed his son. He's killed his first wife.
Well, can I just add that part of the dig at Catiline is not, I mean, you'd think killing your son is the worst thing you can say, but part of the dig is that he marries Orestilla and there's all of this concentration on her beauty. And there's a suggestion that he marries her because of her looks, which we might think is a bit surface level, but for the Romans, it was ridiculous, a stupid reason to marry.
Really?
She's also extremely wealthy. This is where he gets his second fortune from, or third fortune, wherever we are by now. But it's fine to marry for money. The idea is he should have married her for her money, but he actually married her for her looks. And that's just silly. And although, as you have pointed out, she's absolutely a good match on paper.
Yeah.
She's wealthy. Her father's a consul. Why would an elite Roman not marry her? But the concentration on her beauty is our sources telling us Catiline is doing this for bad reasons.
Okay.
That's the only reason that's there.
So the spin can make it look like it's a bad thing. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Okay. The next one is really bad as well. For this, he was prosecuted in 73 BCE, so a decade before the conspiracy happens. He was probably brought to trial for adultery with a Vestal virgin.
Wow.
This is serious stuff. If you are found guilty, then you will be scourged to death with rods.
Yes. And I remember Vestal virgins at this point were buried alive for punishment.
It had happened in living memory, and that's what would have happened to her.
Mm.
Now, his good friend Catulus, remember the guy that he might have avenged his father's death by murdering Gratitianus, right? Catulus's father had been prosecuted successfully.
Yes.
And then executed. Okay, so he testifies in Catiline's defense and he is acquitted. Now, Cicero mentions this, but he doesn't name Catiline. So it's a bit of a problem. The source mentioning Catiline comes from the 4th to 5th century.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah. But to complicate things even more, maybe the reason that Cicero doesn't go into too much detail is that we do know the name of the Vestal, and she's called Fabia, and she is the half-sister of Cicero's wife.
Right.
So maybe it's not something he wants to dig into very much, even if he could use it against Catiline. Because if he says that's true, then he's saying that somebody he's related to is also guilty of this terrible crime, which brings the Roman state into danger. So we can move happily along to the next crime here, which is incest. He was accused of marrying the daughter of his mistress. This is also from Asconius, so that commentary on Cicero's election speech.
Yes.
But Asconius doesn't even name the women. He says he doesn't know the names.
Okay, so we don't know who's the daughter, who the mistress is.
Yeah, and some sources seem to suggest it's the daughter of a wife, so it might even be Orestilla's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very, very vague, and therefore I'm not sure we can put much faith in it.
Not submittable to the court, okay.
I'm afraid not. And then it just kind of gets piled on. He's charged with several murders of rich equestrians. This is in 64.
Just arbitrarily?
Yeah. Okay. The trial is dismissed, though, and that's why we don't know much about it. And the man in charge of that court at this point is one Julius Caesar.
Ah.
Now, this is going to come back to haunt everybody, but Caesar and Catiline, because, spoilers, Caesar's going to be involved in what judgment we should make of Catiline, and he wants to be sparing of him.
Ah, right.
All right,
okay.
And we'll see that particularly towards the end of Sallust, and when we're looking at the end of the conspiracy and the aftermath, and Sallust makes it clear that Caesar is quite prominent in the defense of Catiline. So there's always a bit of suspicion, which will sort of hang around to haunt Caesar, that he wants to go easy on somebody who has conspired against the state.
Mm.
And maybe Quintus Cicero, we don't know, in that, I don't know if you remember that little handbook on elections. When we did a podcast on elections, we talked about this.
Yes, so Cicero wrote a handbook to give his brother guidance on getting elected.
So it's his brother writing the handbook for Cicero.
Oh, other way around, sorry. Okay.
And we don't know if it really is Quintus Cicero, the brother. That little handbook on electioneering accuses Catiline of violating young boys almost in the lap of their parents.
Right.
Which is hyperbole in the extreme, obviously, but, you know.
I don't see how that would get you elected.
This is the kind of thing you want to accuse your opponent of in order to defeat them in an election.
Yeah, it's real muckraking, isn't it?
It is muckraking. It's tabloid press stuff, isn't
it?
I
want to say, you know, to a certain extent, there's so much where there's smoke, there's fire. So he can't have been a great guy. But at the same time, all of that so much is coming from pretty much the one source.
Yeah, I mean, you can trace it all back, almost all of it back to Cicero in some way or another through a commentary or a fragment or whatever.
Or a brother.
A possible brother. and it also seems like a kind of roll call of what are the worst crimes, the worst moral crimes.
Mm.
Because, of course, a lot of building up, this is a person you shouldn't elect, or in Cicero's case, eventually it's going to be, this is a person we should eject from the city, is about saying that their moral character is appalling. You know, they are immoral. They're somebody who can't be trusted.
So it's not just murder. It's murder of his brother-in-law, or it's murder of his wife. It's not just adultery. It's with a Vestal Virgin, you know.
How much can you pile it on? And then it's incest. And then, yeah.
Wow.
Exactly.
Okay. Or as other people might call it, a model politician. Model qualities for a politician.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of reckonings happening at the moment, aren't there?
So let's talk about his political career. With this terrible reputation and this picture of bad character that we're building up then, what kind of politician is he, and how does his career progress at this point? Does he carry these bad sort of qualities through?
Yes. So his first attempt at the consulship is in 66 BCE. So he's putting himself up to be consul of 65. Mm. But before that, he was climbing up the ladder. He'd been quaestor, then he gets to be praetor in 68 BCE. Because he's been praetor, he gets to be a proconsul, governor of Africa. Cicero talks about this in a much later speech, not about Catiline, but actually in the For Caelius, the Pro Caelio speech. Not to get too far into the weeds, the reason for that is that the person he's defending, Caelius, has been accused of being a mate of Catiline's.
Right.
And by the 50s, that is...
You don't want any association with Catiline.
So he's kind of working out a way that he can say, oh, you know, it was nothing, it didn't mean anything.
Mm.
So he talks about how Catiline was... a terrible governor in Africa. He was accused, even while he was in Africa, of extorting fortunes from his province, which is kind of a regular thing for Roman governors to do, but it must have been really bad if there are delegations coming from Africa, from the province of Africa, to complain in the Senate about this, even while he's in office. So it's pretty clear that after those 2 years, i.e. in 66, he's going to be brought up for extortion in the extortion court. In fact, Cicero is in charge of the extortion court at this point. And I think this is worth bearing in mind, because if you want to, as some have, think of Catiline and Cicero as being eternal enemies from the start, this is not the case. Cicero doesn't immediately pick up this case and run with it. You know, it's got to happen at some point. But Catiline actually makes it back into Rome and there's no immediate action.
Mm.
However, because he knows that it's only a matter of time, Catiline, and also because he's ambitious, I guess, he puts himself forward to be consul of 65. So in 66, he's going to be running a campaign.
Oh, so you're saying that he's running as kind of cover?
Possibly, yes. I mean, certainly that will give him immunity if he becomes consul. It's complicated, actually. This is not a regular election. This is the state that politics has got into by this point. You've already got two people elected as consuls for 65, but they've both been dismissed in a huge scandal. These scandalous circumstances are that they've been prosecuted for electoral bribery.
Wow.
And we know from reading that pamphlet on electioneering that something close to bribery is pretty much expected. You know, you're sort of buttering people up.
Yeah.
So this must have been absolutely appalling for them to be prosecuted.
For the Romans to go, oh, hell no.
No, Catiline's already been a really bad governor, and they've had to get rid of these consuls before they even get into office.
Yeah.
And Catiline isn't allowed to stand, possibly because of these delegations coming from Africa. This is what Asconius suggests. There's also evidence that maybe because of what was going on in Africa, the letter of the law says he can't stand because he hadn't put up for it by the time you were meant to.
Okay.
But of course, by the time you were meant to is when those two people who've just been rejected were running for election.
So a technicality, is maybe.
It's absolutely a technicality if that's the reason. But he doesn't get to stand. So this is, I guess, part of that thwarted ambition starting. And that's going to continue. And one of the reasons that certainly we get depicted in our sources that Catiline eventually goes for violence over just standing for election is he keeps being blocked. And in the end, it just gets too much.
Mm.
So he doesn't avoid his trial for extortion. It goes ahead. In his letters to his mate Atticus, Cicero says, oh, I know he's guilty. Like, it's obvious.
Oh.
It's just blatant. Of course he's been extorting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's considering being on the defense team. So much for Cicero's principles, huh?
Yeah, I know. But that's the role of a lawyer.
I guess.
You defend your client whether they're guilty or innocent. And
yeah, that's a kind of modern reading of it.
Yeah, I know it is. I know.
He doesn't actually take part in the defense, clearly. And I think it's because he thinks it's not in his interests to make maybe some enemies over the way.
Mm.
But at the same time, he says, oh, you know, if Catiline gets off, then maybe we can both run for the consulship. So we can be a team for the consulship. That is what Cicero's thinking at this point, which is really interesting.
Yeah, well, it kind of means that, you know, everything that Catiline has done up to this point, whether true or false, doesn't really bother Cicero, or Cicero doesn't think it's out of the ordinary. It doesn't make him unworkable.
Mm.
The only reason it becomes an issue is the later context of Cicero versus Catiline.
Which is why almost everything we've said in this podcast has to be taken as it's all written in hindsight.
That letter to Atticus, though, that's an in-the-moment letter.
It is.
That's the most accurate thing that I think we've said in this podcast when we've been quoting a source.
It is, and it shows us that Catiline is not an unacceptable collaborator, somebody that you would work with, who can be part of this republican political system. And this is in 65 BCE, and the conspiracy, so-called, is in 63, so we're not too far away.
Not too far away. We're getting there. So the trial goes ahead. So what's the outcome of it?
He gets off.
That doesn't surprise me.
There's probably bribery. We've got a nice little thought on this that comes from that electioneering pamphlet, which might be by Quintus Cicero, who says, I think I should not omit to mention that he, Catiline, left that court in the first place as needy as some of the jurors were before the trial.
So it sent him broke.
Exactly. He had to put a lot of money out. And in the second place, the object of such hatred that another prosecution against him is called for every day.
That was Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history from La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we'll take a look at what might or might not have been the first conspiracy of Catiline. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe or leave a review, tell your friends about it. Hey, we'd really appreciate that. You can follow Emperors of Rome on Facebook. We are on what is left of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. Or hey, send us an email. That's a new idea. emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Emperors of Rome is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. Until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.